Махараджи говорит, что
Шри Шетар Махарадж says that music
обладает могуществом привлекать сердце.
Has power to attract heart.
Yes.
Но она может быть опасной.
But it can be dangerous.
Yes.
Почему?
Why?
For that very reason. He's saying sound, and in this case, music, it goes to the heart. So if that music is mundane, then you're putting mundane influence into the heart. Right? This music, where did it come from? Who is it generated by? And what for what purpose? So through the medium of sound, that everything is carrying some conception. So what is the conception of this music? Is it nirgun or sagun? Other than kirtan, we know, we'd say saguna. And if you wanted to be generous, you could say, oh, in the sattvagun. But actually, not. So it's pointing to the importance of sound. So there's polluted sound and purifying sound. What sort of sound is it? So a certain amount of music is inescapable by the environment that we live in. But it has this power, as Guru Maharaj says, to penetrate to the heart region, and then we say, and what concept is being injected there? That is the difficulty. So, saguna, nirguna. So, golokera premadana harinama sankirtan. The harinam sankirtan is descending from Goloka Vrindavan. Just at Srila Saraswati Thakur, we hear from Srila Guru Maharaj that he did not approve of the harmonium in kirtan. And Guru Maharaj maintains the same position, that mridanga and kartals, coal and kartals, this is the eternal paraphernalia of Mahaprabhu. It's not that because he appeared 500 years ago and certain things weren't available. That's not the case. Mridanga and kartals are his eternal paraphernalia. When Srila Saraswati Thakur, on his disappearance bed, called Srila Guru Maharaj to his side, and this is exclusively within the realm of kirtan, he asked Srila Guru Maharaj to sing Sri Rupa Manjari Pada. And Guru Maharaj, his personality, and his own words, back pushing, he means like staying in the background, shy, non-assertive, he's hesitating. So the manager of the Gaudiya Math, knowing that another devotee was revered and for his kirtan ability, a kirtaniya, a good singer, he indicated to him, you start singing the song Sri Rupa Manjari Pada. And he began singing, and we could say, very nicely, very sweetly, and he was stopped by Saraswati Thakur, who at that time said, and that devotee performed kirtan so many times and in the presence of Saraswati Thakur. But this particular time, Saraswati Thakur said, I'm not interested to hear the sweet tune. But rather, he wanted this to be sung, expressed with a particular quality of heart. So Saraswati Thakur, he can detect that. It doesn't mean if we say, oh, there's some tape where he's singing, that you'll get the same thing. We're not interested in the things of this world that are generated from downward, to use things that come from down to go up, but rather what is descending from the upper world, descending into this plane. Sometimes Mahaprabhu, we're told, he in his ecstasy, he cannot say the name Jagannath. He's saying, ja, ja, ga, ga. He cannot say Jagannath. Does that mean that he's inefficient? There's a deficiency in his expression? Or is this rather the outcome of the purest type of expression? So we can't judge these things or measure these things with our mundane ears. I mentioned this sloka the other day. Tad bhakti yoga paribhavita hrit saroja ase shutekshita pato nanunata pungsang. It says, shutekshita. Ashe shutekshita pata. What is this pen? It says, shruta ikshita. What the, a type of seeing through hearing. So to recognize the quality of a particular substance, it will not be, in this case, what is pleasing to the ear, that type of sound. What is pleasing externally, but what is touching internal aspect. That's why in Vedic culture, musicians, actors, they're performers. They're generally referred to within that cultural context and social stratification as shudras. In the modern world, they exalt musicians and dancers, but they're in the Vedic culture, it's from the lowest section of society. Musicians, dancers, singers, it's that kind of thing. You know, they're hired for events. I remember once when, during Gaur Purnima, I had to go somewhere, I'm coming back, and there are many, you know, kirtans going on in different place near the Mat. What is that place nearby called? Haritala? I mean, there's some kirtan going on there. And these people are really expertly singing and playing. I mean, you know, from an external point of view, amazing. Mridanga players, singers, just, you know, jaw-dropping performance. And so, because I just experienced that, and then I went to give dandavats to Gurudev, and I said, you know, half in a light way, but I said, those sahajiyas down the road, they're having an amazing kirtan. And Gurudev said with a straight face, he goes, they're not sahajiyas. And I thought, uh-oh, I've committed some offense, And I was, and Maharaj goes, they're professionals. So professional, you're talking like, they have their fake book. What is it? Oh, we're doing, Ma Kali Kirtan. Oh, okay. Turn to that section of the book. And then, you know, with great feeling, flair, dancing, tears are coming, bodies shaking, you know. Oh, tonight we're doing Shiva Kirtan. Oh, okay. It's in the back of the book? Yeah, it's in the back, you know. Oh, now we're doing, this is Mahaprabhu and Nityananda. Oh, good, I like that. That's what he said. They're not sahajiyas, they're professionals. So, and what do they tell in the music industry? I mean, not to fault them, but they will say, the singer has to sell the song. They will tell the one person, you have to sell it. And they'll say, even if you don't feel these things that are being said, you've got to sell it to the audience if you want to be successful. Saying, but I'm not feeling that. That doesn't matter what you're feeling or not feeling. And you will have to learn, despite what you're feeling, same if you're an actor. You think they don't have a bad day? That every day they're filming, they're just in a good mood? They're like anyone else. Have a good day, a bad day. Someday things are, their relationship is falling apart or something happened in their family or whatever, and then they have to do a comedy or do some other thing. So Rupa Goswami has cautioned, given the caution with regard to about what is genuine divine emotion, saying two things to avoid. One, acting. Someone can act these sentiments. And then there is sentiment, that someone is sentimental by nature, so they easily are moved to tears or such things. So our interest, when we're not, and when I'm talking about, we're not talking about, we're making some film and there's a soundtrack on it. That's not what we're talking about. That's part of the unavoidable, inescapable environment that we are in. But we're talking about spiritual culture. So in pure spiritual culture, this has no place, really. Right. So when sometimes at the mat, someone who had never been there before, they heard some kirtan in the temple or some singing, and they're very excited by that because that style different than what they had known previously, and they would tell Guru Maharaj, oh, so-and-so leads a very sweet kirtan, they said about this one devotee of Tamat. And Guru Maharaj was a little incensed. He responded immediately. He said, his argument is sweeter. He didn't like to hear that. It sounds odd. I'm just telling you the truth. If too many people were complimenting the singing of a particular person, that told Guru Maharaj that a performance is going on. He didn't like to hear that. And it doesn't mean someone's not dexterous on the mridanga or the kirtan, but this, he didn't like it. It told him that the emphasis is going towards performance. And so we've seen, even in the realm of kirtan, we went on Bhaktivinoda Thakur's appearance, disappearance, one of those days to the Swananda Sukhada Kunj. Many Gaudiya Math groups have assembled there. It was his appearance day. And they're singing these songs, and you think, oh, how nice. All the people, they know all the songs by heart. It's all Bengalis, mainly. But then from each mat, they put forward, like, their best mridanga player, best singer. That's understandable. But after a while, start noticing like little competitiveness on certain type of song. Who can sustain a particular note higher, louder, longer, that kind of thing. So, even we have some devotees who are professional singers, but they know when it comes to time to sing the kirtan, they sing differently. Has to be egoless and not a demonstration of vocal ability. their vocal ability may be great range, but for kirtan, they will, constrain that. Srila Gurudev would sometimes say, and one's and his family, they're professional also singers. He has had a great range of vocal ability. Most of the time he is suppressing that a little bit for the kirtan and the singing of the songs. To not allow to become an egoistic performance. And this is complicated because we understand, if you read closely in Chaitanya Charitamritam, you'll see some instance where it'll say, and the singer Mukunda or Srivas Thakur began singing in Gurjuri Rag. So we might say, oh, what is that? We should learn that. It's in the book. But we're not being told to search that out. I once said to Gurudev, as we've heard so many melodies for Maha Mantra, and I said, where did the Sahajis get all these melodies from Maha Mantra? He said, from us. He said, but then once it became associated with them, we disassociated ourselves with that. So in principle, it's kept very simple. And the best resource and model for these things are the recordings we have of Srila Gurudev singing in front of Srila Guru Maharaj on various holy occasions. That's the standard. And those who are musicians, they know more than anyone the kind of stranglehold that music can have on the heart. They themselves know that. So we're on the basis of this caution from Guru Maharaj, we're mindful of that. We don't want to saturate ourselves with mundane sounds so that it's like an endless loop playing in your brain. Like those who have the good fortune to go on the Navadvip Dham Parikrama, they know you come back at the end of the night, you have the Maha Mantra on an endless loop inside of you, just going and going and never stopping. So they can consider themselves fortunate. But if we give our hearts, that's what really, the heart through the ear, to mundane sound, then that sound vibration will be looping within us. And where is that going to take us? So anyone who's a serious practitioner of Krishna consciousness, they're mindful of these things, and also they make sure that every day they hear spiritual sound, the spiritual songs, the scriptures, shravanam. Then it's shravanam. Shravanam does, in this sense, does not just mean literally hearing something. Shradhan bhuto anushrunayad. It's faithful hearing. sometimes in a technical musical sense is called fidelity. They would speak about fidelity of reproduction means how close it is to the original. Now this is the Guru Parampara, what we hear from Guru, how close, how accurate is our reproduction of what has been heard. That's our concern. Not to modify what has been heard according to our whim or preference. Or thinking that it'll make this more popular. Guru Maharaj's response to that is, Nadanam najanam nasundarim kavitam ba jagadisha kamaye. He's not interested in modifying Krishna consciousness for increased income, followers, etc. Rather, maintain fidelity, being faithful to the original. At the same time, we hear from Saraswati Thakur his motto, Pujala Raghavat Gaurava Bhange, Matala Saru Jana Vishaya Rangi. He is willing to use some bait to bring people in connection with the higher thing. But we shouldn't take our own bait. That's foolish. What's being used as a bait to bring someone, we place the emphasis there, or think that is a substantial thing. Any other question? Okay.
Dear Maharaj, please accept my dandavats. I have a question. Could you please explain it today in broadcast? In introduction to Search for Sri Krishna, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says about liberty as the most valuable gift of God. We must not allow ourselves to be led by those who lived and fared before us. But also we know about necessity of total surrender, pranipat. So question is, what should be decided by me and when I should completely depend on opinion of higher devotees and what I should do when their opinions are different?
This reference from the foreword to Search for Sri Krishna, Reality of the Beautiful, where we included an excerpt from the so-called Bhagavat speech of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So some context is necessary here, but in principle, the way to address this question is what Srila Guru Maharaj would call absolute consideration and relative consideration. Saying these two things are always moving. Absolute consideration, we know, when we say absolute, we mean Krishna, Radha Krishna, the whole spiritual structure. The Krishna side of things, absolute consideration. Relative consideration means where we find ourselves at present. Those circumstances, that time, place, all the things that go along with relative notions. And so he's saying, and how to adjust the two. Saying Srila Saraswati Thakur often said in his final days, you know, religion means proper adjustment. So adjustment between the absolute and the relative. That's what is being asked here. So to understand this Bhagavat speech in context, few things have to be known. One is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had exposure to the so-called American transcendentalist, Emerson. There's three generally taken. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Walt Whitman. These three are called the American transcendentalists for their style and type of thinking. But Emerson particularly, he has a particular style and a way of expressing his thoughts. And he gave a talk on self-reliance but many other things. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it's clear in this Bhagavat speech that he was familiar with Emerson and Emersonian concepts and even took some of them because of their popularity at that time and their usefulness, and he repurposed them in his own talk, such as the section about the useful student like a satellite reflecting light. This is Emersonian conceptualization. So Emerson, he would say, one of his famous quotes, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin," means like ghost, "of little minds and others of impaired thinking," you can say. And they adore this. He said, "A foolish consistency," meaning what was said previously, you feel duty bound and obligated to reiterate the same thing. Not because it's necessarily true, but because it's what you inherited from those before you. So there's a certain assumption about its truthfulness. So people repeat that. It's what the literary critic Harold Bloom calls cant. Like cant, not cannot, but cant, like cantare. There are our Italian representative. Cant, like chant. Cantare means, singing, speaking, but cant in this context means you say some noble-sounding aphorism, right? And then just repeat that generation after generation till it becomes almost meaningless. That's what cant is. It started off as something valuable and then got to the point where it's a cliché. You're not giving anything meaningful. So he said that is to be avoided. So Emerson would say, you, whatever it is you believe today, don't, if you wake up tomorrow and have a different understanding of things, don't be afraid to voice those sentiments on the basis of some allegiance you have to past thought. Right? So why is Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaking like this? We have to understand the context. This is a speech he's delivering to a group of people known as the Brahmo Society. And these people, their idea was to combine like Christianity, Vedanta, to mix everything together, right, through the Brahma conception. So understand the context of what he's saying. This Brahmo Society, they're trying to do this, this Khichdi idea, or what Gurudev would call Lafra, to mix many things together. And their leader, he's also hopeful. He sees in Bhaktivinoda Thakur this You know, bright, shining star, future leader. He's grooming or hoping that he will take that position because of, he can see his intellectual capacity and so many other things. But in this speech, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is parting with them. It's a speech where he's saying goodbye to this. Sometimes people think this is some other type of speech, like about ecumenical and getting everything together. It's not like that at all. He's separating himself from these people. That's why he's speaking in Emersonian terms of saying, you don't, just because some idea came down to you from the past doesn't mean it's necessarily a good one. So he's talking about conforming to the received ideas and traditions of mundane society, or even mundane religion, if you want to include that. We shouldn't think here that he's telling us that we shouldn't follow the path of the Mahajans. That's not what he's saying. And that you should dismiss what they're saying and just rely on your own estimation and opinions of things. He's not saying that. But at the same time, because if you read there carefully, he will say, when he refers to Jesus, calls him the Western Savior, and the noble things he's done, and his movement and cause and all that. And then he says, but we should not neglect the Eastern Savior, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and his movement. So really, he's part of a shift of, he's going to revive the interest of educated people in Mahaprabhu's culture, in Mahaprabhu's movement. So you will read later that many scholars will say, you know, when I was adopting everything European and British, and not only their ways of dress and but their ways of thinking, then when I read Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I was revived about Vedic culture and Gaudiya Vaishnavism in particular. So it has to be understood very carefully and very cautiously. Like Guru Maharaj will give you an example. We revere Ramanujacharya, right, and the Ramanuja line. But one particular descendant in that line, he says something unpalatable about Srimati Radharani. Guru Maharaj will say, at that point, we part from him. He says something unpalatable about her origin. It's from some skewed perspective of things. Or saying, Madhvacharya cannot digest the Brahma Vimohan Leela. So these parts of the Bhagavatam, they're not accepting or de-emphasizing. We part with them on that. But we shouldn't think then ourselves, then we're going to sift through the inherited wealth of our Guru Varga and decide this section, I'm uncomfortable with this, I don't accept that. And he's not encouraging one to move in that way. That's why I said relative consideration, absolute consideration. So in answer to this question, relatively speaking, you may have to make some adjustments. You see, you're in a particular culture with a particular people. They have particular customs, things that are acceptable, unacceptable. You may have to make some adjustments for them. As we find in preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world, we have to be sensitive to the local culture. That's a relative adjustment. But on the absolute side of things, we're not meddling with that. That's in the upper world and the higher world. We may make relative adjustments to bring people in connection with that. And when you say pranipat, Srila Saraswati Thakur Groomer said, that means I'm finished with the experience of this world. Right? And what is this world? Really, it's the egocentric world where I decide, it's my own self-imposed criteria. What's wrong? What's right? What's desirable? What's undesirable? And that's becoming replaced by sadhu, shastra, guru, Vaishnav. Their criterion about what is desirable, undesirable, favorable, unfavorable. So, on the one hand, it's the devotee, I'm just referring to this question, they say, and I mean, Guru Maharaj asked Saraswati Thakur once, what if one omniscient disagrees with another omniscient? Then what do we do? You mean in the devotion line? We just said, up to a point. The Ramanuja line, we accept. Madhu line, up to a point. But when he said, well, Sanatana Goswami concludes Krishna Leela in this way, Rupa Goswami in another way, Saraswati Thakur said, it is adhoksaja. It's beyond what can be estimated, verified, argued about with our mind and intellect. But in the practical application of service, there's a hierarchy of service, of servitors, from guru, guru's representative, to surrogates and representatives. If someone found themselves in a situation where one representative of guru is saying this, another is that, then they can bring it to the attention of superiors, saying, I'm being given conflicting orders. But that's a relative position. When it comes to the absolute side of things, we mean, for example, Gaudiya Siddhanta. Then only experts can determine what is superior, like Guru Maharaj has shown in the Ramananda Samvad. Iho bahya age kaho, that's external, go deeper, and then my, you know. Iho hoy age kaho ar, Mahaprabhu going deeper and deeper. Rupa Goswami gives that kind of analysis. And we can see very respectfully, Krishna's Kaviraj Goswami may say, this was expressed in one place, but a deeper, more intimate, personal understanding of Mahaprabhu will move in this direction. That's another thing. We shouldn't confuse these two things, that absolute plane, and then here in the relative world where we're trying to make adjustments. It's like on the battlefield. The general tells all the soldiers, move in this direction. Go to the right. They're all going to the right. Then some new information comes in. Things have adjusted. The battlefield has changed. Tells everyone to move to the left. I said, well, previously he said move to the right. Yeah, but it's a living thing. Now he's being told move to the left. One German follower of Saraswati Thakur, who was in India and going on the programs with him, he said at one point, he said, in Germany we're accustomed to make a program 3 months in advance. He said, so I know you can't give me 3 months' notice, but if you could give me 1 week notice, that'll be good for me. I can adjust myself and arrange everything. And Saraswati Thakur said, I only got notice 5 minutes ago. So how can I give you 1 week? I found out 5 minutes ago, and I'm telling you.
Welcome to Kolkata.
Yeah, and that I had a friend who his seva for Bhaktivedanta Charity Trust was the work under the direction of Guru Maharaj and Gurudev to finish the mat. Some things were unfinished at the time of Srila Prabhupada Swami Maharaj's passing. So top of the list, we said, finish the Nat Mandir of Sridhar Maharaj and some other things. And that devotee, I mean, he shared all these things in a delightful way. He would go to Guru Maharaj and Gurudev about the work and they'd tell him what needs to be done. Then they'd come back and they'd change a little bit. It was something else. And they kept changing. And someone higher up was expressing some concern about that. So he told him, try and get them to just agree to what this will be. And he said at that time when he very tactfully, diplomatically approached this subject with Srila Guru Maharaj, that Guru Maharaj said, told him the story of the Madras Gaudiya Math and said, Saraswati Thakur changed the plan something like 27 times. But we're not changing Gaudiya Siddhanta 27 times. That we understand in a particular way. There's greater depth of understanding, but it moves in a particular way, a particular line. But relative consideration, we're in the world, we're trying to bring people in connection with that, then sometimes you're the person who has to make the call locally. What to do? Sometimes there is no one to consult. What to speak of getting conflicting advice, sometimes there's no one to consult. I mentioned some things to Guru Maharaj in the beginning, of promoting him in the Western world and trying to get as much advice possible about what to do and what we were doing. And Srila Guru Maharaj would say, often, almost inevitably, invariably, he'd say, you're the man in the field, you decide. So some decisions we have to make personally. And then how do we do that? The same way our superiors do. What Guru Maharaj is saying, thinking of Sadhu, Shastra, Guru, and Vaishnav. These are the statements of the scriptures. These are the statements of our Guru Varga, of our Guru. These are the statements of his superior, senior, reliable servitors. Considering all those things, with, you know, a bowed head and folded palms, we proceed. As Guru Maharaj said, we should not be overly confident in our own assessment of things. That leads us to consult with, his words, you know, superior, senior, reliable devotees. We consult with them. We find in the pastimes of Mahaprabhu, even the superior devotees consulting with those in a junior position. It was the case of Sanatana Goswami with Jagadananda Pandit. Sanatana Goswami is worried about his situation with Mahaprabhu and he's thinking, maybe it would be better for me to return to Vrindavan. He consults Jagadananda Pandit. Jagadananda Pandit said, I also think that's a good idea. Right? Then Sanatana Goswami is fine. But when, interestingly, when Mahaprabhu hears about this, he's chastising Jagadananda Pandit and saying, what audacity you have to instruct Sanatana Goswami. And he's saying, Jagat, he's a boy and has the audacity to instruct Sanatana. But that said, a point that's also noteworthy, though, is that that's how Mahaprabhu felt, but Sanatana Goswami didn't think, oh, he's junior to me and not worthy of consultation. He thought, he's with Mahaprabhu, and so I will ask him, get his opinion. So if such a great devotee as Sanatana Goswami, he's willing to consult, then what should be our position? In the case of conflicting instructions, we appeal to the higher. in all these pastimes, we see the higher devotees, their humility, and not being overly confident in their own judgment or assessment of things, always willing to consult with others. But when he says in the beginning of that liberty is the greatest gift, he means that's an innate, inseparable aspect of being a jiva. It's what distinguishes a jiva from a piece of stone, right? Is free will. But if you want to understand really what he's saying, then you can, knowing his conclusions, take you in the direction of Mahaprabhu, Radha Govinda, that conception. Then you can work your way from there and understand what he's getting at. He's not talking about some whimsical rejection of received wisdom. He's just reminding people in an Emersonian style that what you've heard up to this point, there may be more to be heard. There may be a superior truth that can come to you. And you cannot deny that superior truth in the name of allegiance to an inferior truth. That's his point. Yes.
God like a son, the truth like a son, and the receivers, there should be like reflecting light stars.
Contains this. Well, I'll say what he says.
Sure.
Well, wait, that's not what he says.
Okay.
So we have to say first what he says. Before you came in, I mentioned a little bit about this, that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this speech, it's written in the style of Emerson. Anyone who's read Emerson knows that. And we know he sent his book, like the Life and Precepts of Mahaprabhu, to Emerson. And I think there's maybe even some acknowledgement from Emerson that he received that. So, and Emerson is a very important thinker at that time in the 19th century. And Emerson's known for, you know, rugged individualism. And he has these examples he uses. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur's using one of them and modifying it there. Right? Now, the way Emerson says like this, he's saying, you know, a student should not merely be like a satellite reflecting light from another author. He said, but he should become a system. If he's a real student, right, he should be himself become a system. What does that mean? Like solar system, a sun with so many planets orbiting it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he says this a little differently than Emerson. He's saying the useful student, like a satellite, should reflect light from the original. Right? But what's ironic is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he became a system. He's not just a student of he's a system. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is a system. He's our system. At the heart of our like conceptual ontological solar system is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Right? So, but he's saying a useful student should reflect the light given by another author, but he's not limiting it that to the reflection. Whereas Emerson, his original example that he gave was a little bit different laid out, but the emphasis on becoming a system. But see, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he's already part of a hierarchy from the spiritual world. Someone like Emerson, he's thinking about like the Hegelian dialectic, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and making progress towards this ultimate truth. You know, it's like an ascending process. Bhaktivinoda Thakur is descended from that plane. He's not trying to, in that sense, discover the ultimate reality, rather to reveal that. But he presents himself in his life and his pastimes as an explorer or a discoverer. So as part of that Brahmo society, he's familiar with the teachings of Jesus, and they think he's a promising candidate to lead them in the future. And then he's revealing to them, but then I discovered Chaitanya Charitamritam and the Western Savior, Sri Gauranga. And then that's why it's called the Bhagavad speech. He's trying to take them all in this direction. He's not presenting, yes, let's just mix this all together. It's not one of those kind of talks. He's saying, I've been there with you on this, and I find what he's really saying, in essence, is this is superior.
Just to continue the question, which is your take on Emersonian principles, quite interesting, because supposedly in a spiritual, you know, group of receivers, or the people that Bhaktivinoda addressing to. See, I don't believe that he's only telling goodbye without any explanation what he's accepting and going deeper.
Yes.
Why, the question is this, like different reflectors, different people with different devotees. Why certain people cannot have further progress? Because we can see it.
Because
we can see there are different.
One major obstacle, impersonalism. So they were called the Brahmo Society. They did not accept a personal absolute. They accept Brahman as being supreme.
Okay, that's within outside.
Like Guru Maharaj mentioned, who is it, like Rabindranath Tagore or one of them? He said at his deathbed, he wanted to hear, you know, Satyam Shivam Adwaitam. Not Satyam Shivam Sundaram. Hare Krishna. So this becomes the sticking point. As we told when we spoke yesterday, that some of the greatest minds or thinkers of the West, if they're pressed about God, if it's Brahma, you know, formless, nirakar, Brahma, that they can accept more. But if you start talking about God as a person, the personality of Godhead, that's their minds explode. That they cannot accommodate. But it appears to be on account of some sort of acquired prejudice.
Right? Well, can we say that certain people making judgment based on their own experience, personal
perceptions? Yes, that's what I said, acquired prejudice. So because a person, they're imposing the mundane limitations, apparent limitations of personality, upon a divine personality.
See, but their statement is, what their anti-statement is, oh, very well, you're talking about personal God, but how come your personal God has mundane limitations? How come he has affinity or, you know, love to his devotees, hate for non-believers or the demons? How can you, like, give to your God such a, you know, your God seems like too much personal.
No, that's the point. That as we are persons, God is a person. It's very similar, except the degree of magnitude. So it's more easily understandable why he would have love and affection towards certain people and be neutral towards other or averse to others. Because we're like that. Everyone knows when people, whether they're politicians or reporters and they claim objectivity, everyone knows that ultimately it's impossible to be 100% objective. Right? That's why some people say, therefore we need robots. But we know in science fiction that the robots, they can't be trusted either. And they'll end up liking their own kind of robot. Right? Yeah. So what I'm saying is that, and I talked about this last week, that in Bhagavad Gita it says, Sangmoham sarvabhush teshu na dveshos tinapriya. I'm not, you know, I'm neutral. I'm not friend, dear to some and against others. I'm neutral. But I thought, well, where is Krishna neutral? As Paramatma. Paramatma, we can say, is genuinely neutral, although sympathetic, right, to the suffering condition of the jiva. So as Paramatma, he's neutral. But we hear from, in the Bhagavatam, Krishna, you know, they say, Ahang bhakta paradino yasvan tantra ivadvija. In the presence of devotees, although I'm independent, as Hegel says, reality is for itself and by itself, in the presence of devotion, it's as if I lose my independence. So we're told devotion is quantified, demonstrated, where the infinite comes under the control of the finite, which is an extraordinary, if not inconceivable, thing. That's why Gromer says, then which finite can you trust with that? That the infinite will come under their control. And what would it be about them that would cause this to come about? That they've evolved to, they know a lot? What is that for someone who by definition is omniscient? Right? They know everything. Are they going to be impressed with the knowledge of a jiva? Like it's been pointed out by different scholars that some of the greatest thinkers of the last couple hundred years or whatever, not to take anything away from them, but if you look carefully at their concepts or philosophy, you can understand it has very much to do with the time that they lived in. We're back to absolute and relative consideration. Based upon the particular culture of human civilization or Europe or Vienna or whatever it was at that time, they came up with a particular way of viewing things. So it means at best, it may be brilliant, but it's a relative perspective of things. We're talking about the finite coming in connection with the infinite and getting, as it were, infinite perspective, which is far beyond, that's beyond the sum total of the finite infinite perspective. So in these statements of the Bhagavatam, and elsewhere, we're getting infinite perspective. In Chaitanya Charitamritam, you're getting not only infinite perspective, but candid thinking of Krishna, candid revelations of his own interior thinking about what is appealing, saying that if someone... I mean, in one sense, see, we take this for granted, but it's shocking, it's revolutionary for God, for lack of a better word, because that's what people, they'll understand more if you say, for him to say that if people are, overwhelmed thinking about my divinity or my majestic aspect, personally, I'm disappointed. that seems to contradict everything. We go, well, wait a minute. We're told, like, come to the point of where you can believe in God and with your whole heart and so on, and all these kind of things. Then he's saying, but if you're too much into, like, the omniscient, omnipotent, all these, this majestic aspect, I don't get, what I'm really after is what's in your heart, and you're keeping that from me. With all this awe and reverential devotion, you're keeping that from me. Right? So I'm disappointed. Whereas he's saying, where I live in my world, if my friends challenge me, that, you know, gets my juices flowing. I find that interesting. A finite who's not an offender. We've gone way beyond that, right? Now we're in the spirit. We're not, there's the material world, saguna plane, nirguna plane, nirvana, take a bath in the Viroja River on your way to Brahmaloka, again, you know, Vaikuntha, go higher, Ayodhya, Dwarka, you're in Vrindavan now. So this is not offensive. So that someone can reach the point where his majestic aspect, his divinity, his godness is so far suppressed that they can playfully challenge him to wrestle or whatever it might be. And we're told, you know, and it's a beautiful thing. We've seen the paintings of Vishnu or Krishna on the shoulders of Garuda, right? And it's all those pastimes. They're enchanting. Enchantingly beautiful. Krishna and Garuda and Dwarka. Krishna and what is that? Which queen he went. Anyway, no, those different pastimes. But in, we find out in Goloka, when the cowherd boys have their games, and the game is that the losers have to carry the victors on their shoulders. So now we have Krishna, he's carrying Sudama on his shoulders. And that's making him shiver in ecstasy. We can understand Krishna, Vishnu, on the shoulders of Garuda, how Garuda feels. But Krishna is saying privately, I'm happier when I'm carrying my devotee on my shoulders. I'm the loser and he's the victor, and I have to carry him on. You can't imagine how much joy that gives to me. And it makes complete sense that if you're the infinite and everyone's keeping their distance on account of too much awareness of your infinite capacity in all these different ways, then he's being deprived of the thing that he really desires, which is love, affection, intimacy, like us. Okay. So this, and Muhyanti Atsuraya, what to speak of the finest minds of this world, told, the gods are somewhat bewildered and trying to grasp Krishna conception. That he can be like that, a plaything in the hands of his devotees. That as a child, some, the women in Vrindavan, they're clapping their hands, and he's dancing for them. The ultimate reality, right, the supreme absolute truth, who through one an expansion of an expansion, manifest innumerable universes, and, you know, populated with innumerable living beings, that personality, as a child, can dance to the song and the clapping hands of his devotees like he's a plaything. Or they can tell him, you know, go pick that up. Bring that to me. And who is omnipotent, he can't lift it. That is sweet. that the omnipotent can do this, that, and the other thing, you know, we understand. But the omnipotent, that he can't lift something, is a sweeter idea. Or in the case of Kurma, he appears, you know, like, these are the pastimes of the infant. I mean, the for starters, the asuras and suras have a giant celestial snake they've wrapped around the Mandara mountain, and they're churning the milk ocean. That's like the beginning of the pastime, you know, and their search for Amritam. And but what we're told is that Kurma avatar, Kurmadeva, as a tortoise, a turtle, appears, and he has an itch on his back. So who is omnipotent, right? When he says the Kurma avatar, because he can't scratch his own back. We say, no, he could make one of those hands go, no, he can't. He's accepting these limitations to make the pastime sweeter. That gives, so they put the mountain on his back. So they're churning the mountain, and it needed something too. So the back of Kurmadeva, they're churning the mountain, the milk ocean, and what's coming out? You know, Lakshmi Devi comes out, the moon comes out, like all these amazing things. The elephant of Indra. And because things are being separated, so much poison is going to, an ocean of poison is generated, creates another problem, which is just another pastime. For Mahadev to come to Shiva, drink the ocean of poison, become Nilkanta. But that Kurmadev, so as the mountain is churning on his back, the itch, he's going like, ah. And his outward going breath, it's the Vedas. His breath is generating the Vedas. And it says, Prishte, Brahmyada Manda Mandara Giri, Gravagya, Kanduyanan, Nidralo, Kamatakrite, Kanduyanan. That, and it said, that breathing, and what is his breathing like? It said, it's being mimicked by the oceans. What you hear at a seashore, that almost hypnotic sound, that was the breathing of Kurmadev, like that. And to show the all-accommodating nature of these pastimes, they're searching for Amrita. Mrita, Mrityu means death. Oh, that man's name is Badal. Badal Prabhu. His original name is Mrityujoy, means one who conquers death. So, Mrityu means death. Amrityu, Amrita. Nectar means deathless. So the idea was that it's the drink of immortality. But in this context, that is the most superficial general idea, mundane idea. Who's searching after immortality? The demons in this path, the asuras, they want to live forever because they can't conceive there's any world other than this one to live in. So they've got vested interest in like trying to figure this out, whether through religion or science. But when I asked Guru Maharaj about this, why does this appear in the final chapter of the Bhagavatam, which is a summary of the whole Bhagavatam, considering what the whole Bhagavatam, the crescendo in the 10th canto, what it be presenting, you know, I couldn't understand this. And Guru Maharaj said, no, the reason that this sloka referencing this pastime is given in the final chapter of the Bhagavatam is to show that Amrita, the ultimate nectarine substance, is Madhura Rasa, which is the subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's why it's perfectly presented there. And what is Madhura Rasa showing? That what Prabhupada said in the first verse, referring to Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Adi Rasa, Madhura Rasa, the Eros. If this prospect is not present in the infinite, in divinity, which Saraswati Thakur said, you cannot eliminate this any more than it would be to eliminate our existence. That's how intrinsic it is to our existence. Saying, so if by your philosophy, your explanations, whatever it is, and we come back to what's wrong with Brahma concept, Brahmavad and such thing, Mayavad, if you deny the personality of Godhead, saying then indirectly, inadvertently, you're giving impetus to mundane eroticism, because that which is so hardwired, intrinsic to our existence, this is the only world where that has any possibility for expression. Yeah. So, so Guru Maharaj, he said, and the this sloka is given there to say in a summary form, back to Narada chastising Vyas, that the possibility and the presented and the most wholesome way of saying that there's possibility of a life of love with Krishna. So it's a revolutionary concept if we properly conceive what's being expressed. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, just to tie this thing, he's taking them from some general partial representation of theism or divinity and trying to bring them in the direction of what Guru Maharaj would call full-fledged theism, which is only expressed in its entirety in Krishna conception. The full spectral range of loving relationships being reciprocated by Krishna, the personality of Godhead. Hare Krishna.